Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning. Hope we're doing great and so glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at wliw.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. Each show is archived on my website at annliguori.com, A-N-N-L-I-G-U-O-R-I.com, and distributed on my podcast via Audioboom and iTunes. Well, I can't think of an international competition that rivals the Ryder Cup. Yes, the Olympics are amazing, and I have fond memories of the Olympics, some of which I can, you know, relay some stories here, and then we'll get into the Ryder Cup. But I have fond memories of doing play-by-play for the radio network rights holders at 4 Winter Olympic Games and 2 Summer Olympic Games. And just randomly, I'll never forget covering the 1998 Winter Olympics in Nagano, Japan, when Hermann Mayer, the Austrian bricklayer, his nickname was the Herminator. I'll never forget being in the booth at the bottom of the downhill course, but you know, we were very high up on scaffolding, basically, and watching Mayer crash in the downhill event, literally going wide on a gate and crashing through the netting on the side of the mountain of the course. And it took a couple minutes. He landed, thank goodness, in knee-deep powder, and he was motionless for what seemed like an eternity. And then he got up and walked away. And I remember doing play-by-play of all this while it was going on for, I think it was CBS Radio Network at the time. And he literally came back a few days later to win gold in the Super G and then again in the giant slalom. I mean, everybody thought the guy was dead from this crash. And not only did he survive, he came back to win 2 golds. Just incredible. I'll never forget the press conference later that day when he appeared and somebody asked him, "Tell us about your crash." And in his thick Austrian accent, he said, "It was a good flight, but it was not as good as Lufthansa." I mean, he was literally making a joke out of this very, very serious crash that he had. But thank goodness, not only did he survive, he went on to win 2 gold medals in those 98 Winter Olympics in Nagano. Just incredible. Also remember 2006 at the Olympics in Torino. I was up in Sestriere where the Alpine events were taking place, and watched Lindsey Vonn wipe out in a training run. She was airlifted to a hospital, and she too competed a few days later finished 8th that year. And I remember covering the great Italian skier. Who could forget Alberto Tomba? His last Olympics, it was his 4th Olympic appearance, was in Nagano. And I remember connecting with his people and getting an interview with him for either ABC Radio Sports Network or USA Today. But I ended up meeting him at JFK on his way. He was on his way back to Italy from New York and interviewing him and broadcasting his gold medal win in the giant slalom and his silver medal in the slalom in the 92 Albertville Games. Even way back 1984, that was my very first Olympic, the Summer Olympics in Los Angeles. So we'll never forget those Summer Olympics. I was a producer for ABC Radio Sports Network, and they needed somebody to cover tennis, which was the demonstration sport back then. And they knew I knew tennis. I played tennis in high school and my first year in college. And they told me, go out to Pauley's Pavilion on the UCLA campus where the tennis was taking place. Back then, it was a demonstration sport. And that's where I had my first on-air opportunity for ABC Radio Sports Network. And it also, all the reports went out on Armed Forces Radio throughout the world. So boy, what an entree. And I'll never forget Carl Lewis's 4 gold medals. And all the great moments of those Olympic Games. And back then, the main issue of those Olympics, people thought it would be too smoggy, all the traffic in LA. So all the residents in LA seemed to leave the city. And everybody who had been worried about the traffic, there was literally no traffic in LA. Everybody had left. It was quite extraordinary. Anyway, covering all these Olympics, just so many great memories, so exciting. And equally exciting, perhaps even more so, is the Ryder Cup, the biennial competition between 12 top male players from the U.S. against 12 top male players from Europe and the U.K. And, of course, the next big one just a week away, really, at Bethpage Black. Can't wait. But I've covered every Ryder Cup since 1999 in Brookline. What a special Ryder Cup that was, with the U.S. pulling off the greatest comeback in Ryder Cup history to defeat Europe 14.5-13.5 after trailing 10-6 heading into the final round of singles play. The U.S. team won 8 and tied 1 of those 12 singles matches. And I remember seeing Justin Leonard draining that 45-footer for birdie on the 17th hole at the Country Club of Brookline. And that was the victory that secured the win for the U.S. Unbelievable. Just great memories, so many. And in this sports interview show, longtime sports writer, formerly of the New York Post and the New York Daily News, Hank Gola, who is the president of our Met Golf Writers Association, our executive board. He is the author of a new book out called Ryder Cup Rivals, The Fiercest Battles for Golf's Holy Grail. He's going to join me. We'll reminisce about some of our favorite Ryder Cup moments and get into some of the nitty-gritty of the Ryder Cups that we both have covered through the years. Hope you enjoy that segment with Hank Gola. And you will also hear my conversation with avid golfer, Senior VP, Global Sales for Aer Lingus, Bill Byrne. I talk a lot about golfing in the Emerald Isle on this show, as you know, and Aer Lingus is the best way to get there. You'll learn all about their service and why Ireland is booming in terms of tourism, golf, and industry. Bill Byrne is passionate about the game of golf and certainly loves his job. What a great job to have, going to Ireland via Aer Lingus, promoting golf in Ireland, promoting air travel to Ireland, Aer Lingus, and just being so passionate about the game of golf. So hope you enjoyed this edition of Sports Interview with Anne Liguori. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori, and it is my pleasure to say hello to Bill Byrne, Senior VP for Aer Lingus. Bill, welcome to Sports Interview.
Well, thanks for having me, Anne. It's a pleasure, and for somebody that's covered the sport for a very long time, I'm very happy to be joining you.
Well, this has been a most busy year for travel to and from Ireland, especially from a golf perspective. I mean, you have the Irish Open coming up at the K Club. You have the Women's Irish Open. You had that at the Carton House. And of course, the Open Championship at Royal Portrush this past July. Wow. I mean, so much happening in golf in Ireland. Can you talk about the increase in tourism and the volume of business that Aer Lingus must be encountering?
Yeah, I think relative to golf, it certainly doesn't hurt to have a marquee event like the Open on the island of Ireland. And this is the second time in the last 5 or 6 years that it's been there. But golf's been very much part of the fabric of Ireland for a very long time. Hundreds of years, goes back to the beginnings of golf. Because of golf and because of a whole lot of things, Ireland has grown in tourism. And I think more and more people are thinking about Ireland as a golf destination, and Golf Ireland and Tourism Ireland have done a lot to promote it. When you think about golf, everybody has some list of what the top 100 courses or 50 courses, you name it, right? And half are always in the U.S., and people are very familiar with those. But a quarter of those are between Scotland, England, and Ireland, and about equally divided amongst all three. So Ireland would have a full 8 to 10 courses that are amongst the tops in the world. And then with that comes hundreds of other courses that are really very good and awesome to play, anywhere from the coast to inland, around the country. And so the draw now to Ireland is no matter what part of the island you go to, there could be 20 courses you would be interested in playing. So if even if you came over for a business meeting and wanted to extend a couple of days, you could get 2 or 3 days of golf in at some of the top courses in the world. You could go for a week. And I'll be honest with you, you could go there for a month and get lost in playing courses around the island. I mean, it wouldn't be hard to do and hit bucket list courses every day within that month. So I think travel to Ireland's never been bigger. Most of it is due to our growth. So we fly 21 direct routes, 19 to Dublin, 2 to Shannon, both in the heart of golf country. And then significant investment between the US and Ireland, whether it's pharmaceuticals or tech. A lot of your readers would be in a whole variety of industries that, they would have counterparts or branches or even head offices in Ireland. And so the coming to Ireland, whether it's for business or pleasure or a week stay or 3 day stay or longer, golf could play a role in all of that.
And Aer Lingus can get you very close regionally to, a lot of these links courses, parkland courses. Talk about what American golfers should know about Aer Lingus and the airports and the flights.
So I think we make it very easy for both a golfer and even a tourist in general to get to Ireland. So like I said, we fly from 21 different cities in the, well, 19 different cities in the US, 21 different routes, all nonstop service, state-of-the-art aircraft. If they're a high-end leisure traveler or a high-end business traveler, we have the same kind of conveniences that any other airline would have, fully flat. Business class seats, state-of-the-art cuisine, great lounges, and then the best flight attendants in the industry by far, and as you well know. On arrival, Dublin Airport is very fast and convenient. You can get in and out of it very quickly. So from the gate through immigration and out to the curb, it can be as little as 15 minutes. It's honestly that quick. Departing from Ireland, especially from Dublin, but also from Shannon, you clear U.S. immigration in Ireland. So you arrive in your destination in the U.S. as a domestic passenger. So again, you're from the gate to the curb within 15 minutes, like you would on any other flight in the U.S. So it's really kind of amazing the service that we have for that.
I love that aspect when you clear immigration in Dublin. Then when you come to JFK, you just go right through.
Oh,
I love
absolutely. I
that.
mean, you just walk right out. And if you're thinking about JFK, we're right now in Terminal 7. Walking out from the gate to the terminal, to the curb, to the Uber lot is less than 15 minutes at JFK. And in places like Indianapolis, it can be as little as 10 minutes to leave to get out.
Unbelievable. And people don't
Yeah.
realize how close it really is to fly from, say, JFK to Shannon, even Dublin. It's actually faster, in my opinion, to get over there than it is to go from JFK to LA, right?
Oh, so off the East Coast, you can get there in 5.5 hours. It's a shorter trip than it is going to the West Coast. Now, the West Coast, it's a little bit longer. From the Midwest, like Chicago or Minneapolis or Indianapolis, Nashville, it's 7 hours. So you hop on board, you have a quick meal, you take a nap, and you wake up, and you're in Ireland.
And
It's
that
pretty easy
first
to do.
class business class ha is pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, it's the fully flat Thompson seat, which is the state of the art in the industry. It's fully flat, very comfortable. A 6'6" person would have no trouble sleeping in it. I'm a little shorter than that, so it's easier for me. And if you fly like me, I go to sleep at takeoff and don't wake up until they tell me I got to wake up.
Very
So
smart.
when I arrive in Ireland, I am not the least bit jet lagged.
You are a seasoned traveler for sure, but if you want to do stay up for the meals though, don't you?
Oh, so the meals are fantastic. I mean, Ireland is pioneer. Well, Ireland years ago pioneered farm-to-table cuisine because the one thing great about Ireland, they have concentrations of big cities, but very close to farms. So farm-to-table, great meat, fish, vegetables, all that is very fresh and and cooked really well, and a high European standard. We bring that on board, where the meal service is just excellent.
Yeah, the meals were great. And that's why I know how important it is to try to sleep when you're going from, JFK over. But I always stay up for, for the dinner. And then
Well, the
I want
experience.
to watch the movies too.
Yeah, I mean, the experience is great. So, I mean, there's a way to experience so that everyone would like it.
So talk about your experience, Bill, going to the Open Championship at Royal Portrush in Northern Ireland.
So it's one of the greatest courses in Ireland for sure. It would be on most people's bucket list. But it really is a typical Irish course, where it's on the coastline, link style, with beautiful vistas and cliffs and views of the beach and the ocean. And then, as you could look out over the sea and see Scotland. It's just an incredible view. And there are courses like that all around the island with these incredible views, whether you're thinking about, Old Head down in Cork, or Wardaville in Kerry, and Rosapennan in Donegal, Baltrae and Louth coming down from Northern Ireland,
Right.
Royal County down in Belfast City. So, I mean, it's just, all those courses have these incredible views of beach and sand.
Everybody always asks me what my favorite course is, and I say Ireland because it's so
Yeah.
hard to just when you think you've played the most incredible golf course, whether it's Royal County Down or Royal Portrush or Carn or Inniscrone, or as you said, you go down to the southwest and you have Old Head and gosh, Waterville. You just when you play these great courses, then you'll go like 20 minutes down the road and there's another great links courses. I mean, it's just there's the abundance of golf, of really good golf in
Yeah,
Ireland
not,
just blows me
yeah.
away.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and you can, and you played them, so you know. So if you were out in the West and you played Rosapenna, not far from there is Carn and Enniscrone, where a tee shot is driving into a narrow fairway between these huge sand dunes covered in gorse, which is both challenging and terrifying. In Dublin, you could be lucky enough to play Portmarnock and then want to go out to the island. The island has a fairway where you drive into it that's 8 meters wide.
I love the
I mean,
Island
so
Club.
no room for yeah, so no room for error. I mean, I was so terrified that I got through very easily, but I got through easily because I hit it short. So I flubbed the tee shot, was short, like almost at that narrow part of the fairway, and then just from a launching point, it was easy enough to get there. I mean, those are the kinds of courses that are Ireland's famous for. You could have some course on your bucket list, and there will be five other courses that you should play, or would want to play, or would be delighted that you played, just after going and playing at the bucket list course.
You
And that
must have a
includes Dublin.
dream job, Bill, being a golfer and doing what you do with Aer Lingus.
Well, it's advantageous because you can get away and play. The problem is I haven't been lost for 30 days to play every course that I wanted to play in Ireland. I mean, I have a list. I've gotten pretty far, but certainly nowhere near where I went, nowhere near the kind of courses I want to play. You
Right.
know, another links course that's right in Dublin, and I'm sure you've played it, is Royal Dublin, which is a
Beautiful.
links style course right on the ocean, but with a view of the city. And so you wouldn't get that in a lot of places where you're right on top of the city playing a links style course. Not out in the country, really, as metropolitan as you can get, but it's on a peninsula or an island that's actually sticking out in the ocean. And
I mean,
Dublin did.
if you go to Ireland as a tourist or for business, because I mean, if you go to Dublin, I mean, and talk a little bit about Dublin and how just in the last, gosh, 15, 20 years, the city has expanded in industry. But there's so many courses right around Dublin. You don't have to leave that area.
No, there you could within a drive, if you're in Dublin, within a drive, you could play 10 courses at least that you'd want to play. As far south as Druids Glen, which is in Wicklow, but it's only an hour's drive from Dublin. Or as far north as Baltrae, which is in County Louth, Dundalk. That's an hour's drive. But then in Dublin, you have Portmarnock, which is rumored to be getting the Open very soon. Malahide, Royal Dublin, as I said, the
Island
island.
Club,
I mean, you can go on, and
County
then a
Louth.
short drive. Yeah, and a short drive to Kildare to play the Cake Club or Carton House, which are sites for the Irish Open. I
So
mean, just an
the
incredible amount. And
European
then,
Club is down in.
Mount Juliet's probably 45 minutes into Kilkenny. So, I mean, that's just in Dublin. So in Dublin, there'd be at least 20 courses. So if you went there on business twice a year and you could carve out a day or two, you could play a different course every time.
And it just seems like Ireland has experienced just an economic boost. What, and say the what, past 10, 15 years, would you say?
I think Ireland has been on an economic rocket ship since really the 90s, so 25 years plus.
Okay.
So substantial investment in education in its people spurred investment from multinationals, tech companies like Microsoft, Google, Amazon, pharmaceutical companies like Merck, Johnson and Johnson, and Lilly. Have invested a lot into Ireland and then the ancillary businesses that grow up around it. So whether it's finance or building materials or food staples or nutrition technology, all that is in Ireland. So you have an educated workforce that's on the move. So the GDP grows at a faster rate than most countries. It's populated in a 6 million is the population, which it hasn't grown in population as much as the economic growth would be. But with all that economic growth, you get restaurants and hotels, but no substitute for the pub life as well in Ireland. So there's nothing, after a round of golf, sitting in an Irish pub, there'd be two or three by any golf course that you choose. You can have a meal or a couple of pints and then not be far from a first-class restaurant in any part of the country. So
I
that
mean the
economic growth brings all that with it.
right that the hospitality there really is second to none. But why do you think Ireland has experienced such a growth in the past, say, 25 years?
I think it's probably two things or three things. So first, the investment in people. I mean, they're a country that invests in people, whether it's education, investing in the infrastructure, roads, and all that. Then the second thing is just the passion and desire of the Irish people to engage with the world. Engage with the world not only in commerce, but engage with the world in terms of hospitality and friendship. Americans have been going to Ireland for by air for over 65 years when we first started flights. The Irish have been very engaged with Ireland. With the Americans, they've had a love affair with America for 100 years, not just because of immigration. My parents immigrated to the U.S. from Ireland, but this because of this common bond. It's like their sister country. So every American that goes there is going to get a warm welcome. Most Americans that go there have some Irish in their background. They either know somebody or there's some history in their family. And the Irish like to engage in that. So there's this kind of interpersonal bond that's there. And I think that spurs the economic growth, where you have interest and passion, you have economic growth, and you have all the things that go with it.
And we have the Ryder Cup heading to Adair Manor in
Oh, yeah.
2027. That's going to be huge.
So yeah, and we didn't even talk about that. So the K Club hosted the Ryder Cup, and now the next Ryder Cup will be at Adair. Well, the next Ryder Cup's at Bethpage, but then after Bethpage, it'll be at Adair Manor. JP McManus, the owner of that club, has made significant investments in that property, whether it's hotels, restaurants. They're putting in the infrastructure now. They're ready for it. They've done a lot of research. I first met McManus at the Ryder Cup at Whistling Straits. He'll be at Bethpage. He's doing his research. His team is doing the research. They're very serious about building a world-class golf destination. They certainly have it now. And that part of Ireland is just a beautiful part of Ireland. And I think anybody that's wants to go to a Ryder Cup can do that. And if they want to play golf in and around it, there's plenty of courses to play.
And how soon, Bill, can people book flights for the Ryder Cup in 2027? Because I know it, everybody's very eager for this one, particularly the Irish, obviously, but the American, they love Ireland and want to make sure that they're part of it.
Well, ironically, a tour operator would probably take bookings now. But if you wanted to book air on your own, airlines set their schedules a year in advance, and it's 11 months roughly when they can book. So September 29. No, September 20. I can do my math right. September 27. They'd be booking late October 26 for them.
All right, so that's good to know. So next year they'll
And
put
then
it in their
flights from that,
calendars.
and flights from that would be either be into Shannon, which is a very short drive, but you could also fly to Dublin, drive to Shannon in no time. It's a state-of-the-art motor route, and you can get there in less than 90 minutes.
I know Adair is a little village, very charming village with cottages with thatched roofs and gorgeous church across from Adair Manor. And, as you mentioned, the golf course, they call it the Augusta National of Ireland. It's just in impeccable shape. But what's happening now to be able to handle the influx of all the people who will be going over there for the 2027 Ryder Cup? Do you know anything about how they're going to deal with all the people?
I wouldn't be an expert, but the resort is building out housing capability. The cities and towns around that are also building hotels, so there'll be hotels. We fully anticipate guests staying as far away as Dublin and taking either a train or driving in, but they can also stay in Cork or in Tralee, in Clare proper, like in Ennis near Shannon Airport, as far north as Galway Town, and then into Tipperary. There'll be a variety of accommodations, so not just hotels. I'm sure there'll be, like, for the Ryder Cup at Bethpage, everybody's put their house up for rent through Airbnb. You'll see the same thing in Ireland, I'm sure. And so there'll be a variety of homes that they'll be able to choose from, whether it's a small thatched roof cottage that they could stay in while they're at the matches, or to anything from a nice country estate. So I think housing is not going to be the issue. The issue always at a Ryder Cup is parking, which is plenty at Adair, like it will be for Bethpage, but it's access in and out and how you do it. And you were at Port Rush. The busing system they had there was, I thought, incredible. I was never in a traffic jam. I stayed in Belfast City. It took us just over an hour to get up there. Yeah, a little over an hour to get back, rode in a very nice bus. I thought that was fine, but I had friends that drove and parked right on the grounds. So there's a variety of ways to get there, and they'll make it easy and it'll be convenient.
All right,
So
so
I
you.
think they could stay anywhere. I mean, if you're thinking about it and you say, well, I'd rather stay in Dublin and come in, be a little longer, but you could certainly do that.
Right. They'll have it organized by then for sure. So, last two questions here, Bill. So, you play as much golf as you can. Your schedule's crazy with Aer Lingus, I can imagine. But if you probably have met some of the most fascinating people. So, tell me about a. Maybe an interesting foursome that you've played with that just sticks out in your memory.
So the most interesting thing, so I told you about my casual meeting with JP McManus. I had no idea who he was. So he's a billionaire and one of the richest men in Ireland. And I just sat down at a table and I was drinking coffee and we were talking about something in Irish GAA, it's called. It's Irish hurling. And we're talking about hurling. And he had a hurling team and I was talking about my hurling team. And then somebody says to him, JP, we got to get going. And I look at him, I go, you're JP McManus? He goes, yeah. I go, well, I don't meet too many billionaires where I just have a coffee with and you get up, got on, and then he leaves. So that was one interesting thing. I think the best thing I find out about golf is not necessarily meeting famous people at golf courses because you run into them. It's really the kind of casual interactions you have with people that you may never see again, and that you have an interesting conversation with. They're either ahead of you in the foursome ahead of you or foursome behind you. And it could be anywhere that I've played around the world. I met two guys once from Texas when I was playing in Portugal, and they had flown over and they were driving around Portugal and Spain looking for golf courses to play in. They were in the oil industry, like a lot of people are in Texas. And we talked for about 20 minutes. And it was just that connection with people that you wouldn't normally meet and will never meet again. And you could have a conversation, and it's the golf that brings you together
Sure.
and the love of being outside and enjoying the fresh air. I think that's what's the most extraordinary thing about golf is that you can go to any other kind of sport, and if you're in the crowd, you really can't engage. You know what team they're playing with. They still have a uniform on or a hat on or something like that. But golf, you can actually talk to people about their kids and their where they live and what their parents are doing and what golf courses they've played and what they've had to drink and eat while they were there. It's this interaction you have with people that you really can't have anywhere else. It really does make golf probably, in a way, one of the more intimate activities and traveling kind of events or traveling experiences that you could have. And you're not going to have that anywhere else.
That's
Really,
right.
I find that extraordinary.
The bonding experience in golf with total strangers or with anybody is just extraordinary. And when we did all those TV shows to promote Irish Links, some of my most memorable interviews were with the captains of the clubs and the secretaries and the caddies. And they are so passionate, these captains, and they will spend 24/7 at the club when they're, during their reign as captain. They're just all in. It's a 24/7 job and they just love it. And I always try to meet the captains, the ladies' captains, the men's captains when I go to these courses in Ireland because they're fascinating people and they're just so passionate about golf.
And if you could run into a captain before you go on the tr go on your round, that captain will give you 10 minutes on how to play that course that is as good or better than even a caddy you might hire. Yeah, because they've played it so much and they really know the ins and outs. And you'll enjoy it a lot more. Now, that's not always possible. Sometimes it's just a chance encounter. But I mean, the people that work at these courses love golf. They love the terrain. They can tell you what it's done and what it doesn't do. And it's so funny because they'll tell you two things they hate about it, and they'll tell you five things they love about it. And then as somebody who's just visiting, I see the two things they hate about it, and I'm like, I don't know why that's that bad. I think it's kind of, I think the people that work at Irish golf courses are some of the finest people you'll ever meet.
It is. Golf is a great connector. Aer Lingus connects Americans to Ireland, to golf in Ireland, and to the just an incredible rich culture of the Emerald Isle. Bill Byrne, thank you so much for joining me, Senior VP of Aer Lingus. Continued success on and off the course.
Thanks, Anne. I appreciate it. Thanks for the time.
Thanks so much. With the Ryder Cup at Bethpage Black just a few weeks away, my attention continues to focus on this mega international competition. And we bring in Hank Gola, author of Ryder Cup Rivals: The Fiercest Battles for Golf's Holy Grail, to share some historical perspective. Hey, Hank.
Oh, thank you, Anne. Always good to get up this early in the morning. I only do this to make tea times and for you.
And I believe that. And Hank is also the fearless leader of our Met Golf Writers Association. He's our president and a former sports writer, as you know, for both the New York Post and the Daily News, although not at the same time.
Never. No, that could never
All right. Well,
happen.
before we talk about your book, Hank, and Ryder Cup history, let's talk about Keegan Bradley's six captains picks last Wednesday. Just the fact that he did not pick himself as one of the six. I mean, were you surprised by that?
Yeah, because he was laying the groundwork, it seemed. He got Luke to agree to have the vice captains talk to the players, and it just seemed like he was getting ready to pick himself. And look, the guy is definitely one of the 12 best American players right now, and he's coming off a pretty good FedEx Cup. So it did surprise me a little bit, but then again, Keegan's been full of surprises before.
He certainly is. And, I think it was a wise choice. Although early in the going, I thought he would pick himself. And then as I really started thinking about it after the tour championship, it hit me that, obviously he can fully focus on being the Ryder Cup captain. And as you know, going through the history of these Ryder Cups, it is just such an all-encompassing job. And it would have added so much intense pressure and scrutiny, I think. What if he lost a match, man? He'd never hear the end of it, right?
Yeah, true. I was thinking the way he would have done it was to play himself only once a day, basically in one session on the first 2 days, and then of course in the singles. But play himself early, maybe in the first one or two matches, and then get out there and do his captain stuff. And the same thing on Sunday in the singles. But again, that's putting himself right in half the day, especially on his singles. I don't think it would have been as much of a problem on the first 2 days as it would have been on singles day, especially if, you know, everything comes down to that final day. So yeah, in retrospect, I think he made the right call. But again, I'm a little surprised. It just seemed like he was headed in that direction.
Yeah, it was really. But then I think these guys kind of stepped up, you know, especially toward the end of the season, you know, Sam Burns and Patrick Cantlay, and obviously Ben Griffin had a great season.
Yeah, Cam Young too. Cam Young finished strong too.
I was surprised about Colin Morikawa, although he does have so much Ryder Cup experience. I just don't think, you know, there were just so many other candidates who played better than Morikawa.
Yeah, I agree with that. And that's the one guy I would have taken if Keegan had put himself on. That's the one guy you could see coming off the roster.
But, you know, looking back at the Ryder Cups, you know, that you have covered, and I know I've covered every Ryder Cup. I can't believe this since what, 1999. And so I want to talk about that for a second. You know, that battle at Brookline was
Yeah.
just very, very special for many, many reasons. And from a media perspective, they didn't have one of those huge media tents. I remember being in a room at the Country Club of Brookline. You know, it was a lot smaller. The Ryder Cup wasn't as huge
No.
back then. And what are your memories of that one?
Yeah, well, of 99,
Yeah.
my memory was kneeling inside the ropes directly on line with Justin Leonard's putt
Oh
on
my goodness.
17. And next to me was Tom Lehman's wife. And as soon as that putt fell, she came charging onto the green like Usain Bolt out of the blocks. I mean, she was really out of, and it's my theory that she started the whole stampede and ended up trampling over Jose Maria's line. But I have a vivid memory of that. And of course, Crenshaw and his wagging finger. The interesting thing about that Ryder Cup is, you know, Mark James and all of the UK, all of Europe, was highly critical of the US fan behavior and even the US player behavior on the 17th green. It was tough. It's Boston fans, right? And I mean, they were all over Monty in particular. He had a rough time there,
I remember
and Payne
that.
Stewart actually had to step in and calm down the crowd. But it was always my contention that what he should have done with his team is taken him to Fenway Park and put him in the bleachers while the Yankees were in town and say, "This is what you're going to have in store for you.
Good
This is,
point.
these aren't the staid Augusta patrons who are going to be clapping everything, applauding everything you do. This is a different deal." So I thought that. And again, also that particular Ryder Cup, you know, he didn't play his three rookies the entire time until singles day, and then he stacked them up like dominoes on Sunday. He had them 3, 4, 5, and ended up putting them up against Phil Mickelson, Davis Love, and Tiger Woods. And after Lehman and Hal Sutton won those first two matches, there was a 5-match sweep. And you know, Ann, how momentum goes there. Once you see one color going up on the board time and time again, it affects the rest of the matches because it puts a lot of pressure on the team that's losing these matches, and it just picks up the team that's winning them. So I blame Mark James a lot for that loss, and of course I was happy to see Ben, and you know, he's so into the mysticism and the sacred, is it
Sure.
sacredness of golf. You know, afterwards he was certain that there were fate was at play, and Francis we met was up there helping him.
Yeah, he's all about fate. In fact, I wrote about that in my book, Life on the Green. But I'll never forget, you know, that speech. I'm going to leave you all with one thought as he pointed his finger at everybody. I'm a big believer in fate. I have a good feeling about this. That's all I'm going to tell you. How dramatic, right?
Yeah, it's exactly what you actually quoted him verbatim. That's very good, Ann. But again, I think at that point he had seen the US the European lineup, and I think he took that back to his team room and said, "Look what we could do here, guys. This is possible. We could sweep these first five, and let's go off and running from there."
Well, I was in the media room watching it on the monitor because doing updates on WFAN every 20 minutes, I can't be on the golf course. I have to watch the whole thing. But
Right.
man, you had the front row seat right on that that 17th green when Justin Leonard drained that 45 footer for birdie. And I just remember the media room just erupting in pandemonium, and I could hear the
Yeah.
roars from outside. So that
Well, you
was.
know, Anne, if you've been in those media rooms along with me, and they're split in half. You've got the European press on one side and the American press on the other side. And the European press is much more enthusiastic about their team than we are. We are trained no cheering to the press box. That goes back to Red Smith and beyond him. But the Euros have no problem. Once every time a blue dot goes up there, the entire side of the Euros erupts, and they love their team. I think half the American press is rooting against the Americans sometimes.
Yeah, that's wow. Well, that's another story. But and then another most memorable Ryder Cup for me, and it wasn't perhaps because of the play, but the 2014 Ryder Cup at Gleneagles in Scotland, when Phil
Yeah.
Mickelson threw U.S. Ryder Cup captain Tom Watson under the bus. I'll never forget that. And it was your question that started that whole
That's
thing.
right. It was my question. I feel like I'm a small part of Ryder Cup history. They were getting their rear ends handed to them every time we went over there. And it was like the same scene. Euros are celebrating, champagne everywhere. Everybody's dancing, ole, ole, ole. And the American team has to come trudging into the interview room and sit on a big stage side by side. It almost looks like the Last Supper. And my question was, anyone who was at Valhalla in 2008, what went right then and what's gone wrong since? And Phil, I think he was just waiting for something like that, and he pounced on it. And Tom Watson's just sitting there staring straight ahead as if he's like lining up a putt or something. His eyes didn't move, and he listened to it all. And of course, that led to the formation of the task force and a change in how they picked the team and other things around the team as well.
I was squirming listening to Phil. And, back then, yeah, you had the European team that had won in the same room, as you say, it looked like the Last Supper. But I mean, I couldn't believe it. And then I'm looking at Tom Watson, and I have to tell you, I was impressed. He pretty much maintained his composure
Oh, he did.
while everybody else was squirming.
Oh, yeah. And if you remember, well, with me, when you ask Phil a question, he locks eyes with the questioner and he looks you through and he's answering your question. Well, I wanted to look at the rest of the team and see what their reaction was, but I had to look straight at Phil as he's answering my question. So I had to go back and look at the videotape for that one. But they also came back to Furyk. Remember one of the British guys, British
That's right.
writers said, Jim, what do you think? He didn't know what to
He
say.
just
He
took
said,
himself
thanks a
out of
lot, or
it.
something like that.
Well, then let's talk about the meltdown in Medina of 2012. Europeans rallied from 4 points down in the singles. You know what I remember about that? A lot about that. But Rory McIlroy barely made his tee time. Remember that?
Of course I do, yeah.
He
He was playing in the
overslept.
second match of the day against Keegan Bradley.
Yeah, he overslept. He got the time zone wrong
Yeah,
because it
he
was
mixed up his
central
time zones.
time, and he
And I
needed
think
a
his
police
manager called him in.
escort. He needed a police escort to get there on time, and it was arranged by his then girlfriend, now his wife, who organized that whole thing.
Yeah, well, what happened was the chief of police of whatever city it was out there, where the European team was staying, happened to be at the in the lobby for some reason, not for just for any reason, just stop by or something to see how things were going when this whole thing was unfolded. And they were trying to figure out, well, how is he going to get there? It is traffic and all of this, and you're going to need some sort of police escort to get him there on time. And it was luck that this guy was there, and they were able to put him in a squad car and get him to the golf course. I think 5 minutes later, if they had gotten 2 holes into the match, he would have had to forfeit the match. And they got there. The first match was already getting off, So Rory had no time to do anything else but put on his shoes and go out there and hit driver off the first tee. And he ended up beating Keegan. And of course, Keegan had a great Ryder Cup that year, teamed with Phil. You remember they were just blowing through matches and getting the crowd hepped up and each other hepped up. I think it was Amy said, you know, that you know they were getting jealous of their relationship.
The
It was
bro, the
really a
bro love, the
bromance.
bromance.
And then Davis Love, the captain, did not play them in the final session. And Phil was claiming that they were mentally exhausted and they couldn't go on. And I'm thinking, mentally exhausted? They didn't play a match past the 14th hole, and they're playing alternate shot. I mean, they're taking half their shots in two of those matches. So I remember when I was covering the PGA at Kiowa that year. I was walking along with Mark Bradley, and we were following Keegan around. We're just talking, and he said to me, "You know who Keegan would really love to play with at the Ryder Cup?" And I said, "Well, who's that?" He said, "Well, Tiger. He'd love to get Tiger juiced up because the Americans always had a problem finding the right partner for Tiger. Tiger did fine in the singles, but not so much with a partner. And Keegan thought that he could really get Tiger going. And of course, Tiger did not have a good Ryder Cup that year with Steve Stricker. And I was thinking, well, look, if Phil's so mentally exhausted that he can't get through another match, why don't you just take Keegan and sit Steve Stricker and let Keegan and Tiger go? And who knows what happens? Maybe he does get them juiced. And that, you know, in hindsight, might have stopped all that momentum that the Euros got in that last session, Ian Poulter playing the hero, and prevented what ended up happening on Sunday.
You mentioned Phil Mickelson, and I'd love for you to talk about the impact of LIV on the Ryder Cup regarding Phil.
Well, Phil was, I mean, he would have been the captain in 2024. It would have been Phil and Henrik Stenson, both of whom ended up in LIV. And of course, you know, there would have been great significance to that because of their duel at the Open Championship a few years ago. As much as it's exciting to have Keegan, it would have been so good to have Phil. Phil has No other golfer has captured New Yorkers like Phil. I mean, Phil may be a goofy guy from California, but for some reason, New Yorkers have always taken to him. He's
Sure, I mean, he
always
got
around
labeled the
here.
people's champion.
Yeah, exactly. And it was like that was set in stone. That was so obvious, a no-brainer that Phil would be the captain at Bethpage. He even mentioned it, you know, in the years before LIV, that how he'd love to do that. And man, that would have been great. It's too bad. I mean, what has happened, but I think it took a lot of took out a lot of a lot out of this Ryder Cup.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. You think if LIV didn't happen, Phil Mickelson would have been the captain of this 2025
Oh,
US Ryder Cup
absolutely.
team.
Not even a question. And of course, and Stenson had already been named the captain for 2025. And you know, that
2023,
happened.
2023, I think. Stenson.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. He would have been. Yeah, he was captain 2023 and
Right,
everything.
right. Well,
Absolutely.
finally, Hank, because we're running out of time. I can't believe how fast this went.
Yeah.
Talk about what you think the historical significance of this upcoming Ryder Cup of Bethpage will be.
Well, it's going to be on the grandest scale stage ever in a Ryder Cup. Most Ryder Cups aren't played. Aren't this The golf course usually isn't the story at Ryder Cups. It's the competition. In fact, if you look at where these Ryder Cups have played, they're usually not played at great golf courses, with the exception of the Country Club in Boston and Medina, and then Royal Birkdale over there. And you know, they're just kind of mundane. There's nothing about Bethpage that's mundane. It's a grand scale. It's going to be filled with people. And it's a big, big golf course that's going to put a premium on driving, which is unusual also for a Ryder Cup. And you know, it's a biggie. It's played in one of the world's biggest cities, America's biggest city. And I think it's going to be loud and boisterous and whatever else we expect. The only problem is, at $750 a ticket, I don't know how many strap hangers are going to be getting through the gates.
But they will have passion and they're very knowledgeable. A lot of people don't give New Yorkers credit. You know, everybody says, oh, they're loud and rude. And they are very knowledgeable sports fans and golf fans for sure.
Yeah, for certain, for certain. And you know what? It's comparable to Boston fans, right? And we saw what happened at the country club, and I think this is going to turn the meter even higher.
Well, the book is called Ryder Cup Rivals: The Fiercest Battles for Golf's Holy Grail. I love what Gary Van Sickle, former SI golf writer, wrote on the cover. If you don't get goosebumps reading this book, check your pulse. You may be dead.
Thank you, Gary.
Anyway,
Appreciate
Hank,
that.
thank you so much. You know, for all of us, appreciating the rich history of the Ryder Cup will definitely, you know, get us all even more excited for the upcoming Ryder Cup of Bethpage. Hope you enjoyed this edition of Sports Interview with Anne Liguori, and be sure to pick up a copy of my book, Life on the Green: Lessons and Wisdom from Legends of Golf. Havili Press published it. You can get it at Barnes and Noble or order it online at Amazon.com. I'm really proud of this book. I interviewed 12 legends, 6 men, 6 women, 12 legends in golf, and they all share life lessons and wisdom, what they learned from their iconic golf careers that they use in their day-to-day life. So it's really universal themes for everyone. Whether you're a golfer or not, I think you will really enjoy the messages in this book. And they're positive, uplifting messages. Nothing negative, nothing divisive. This is a real feel-good book. These are messages that you can take with you in anything you do. And whether you're a man or a woman, whether you're young or old, these messages are reminders of what we can do to be better and to motivate ourselves and to live our best lives. Gary Player, 88 years young, talks about his passion and pursuing your passion, no matter what age you are. Gary Player, who's won countless tournaments around the world, he continues to play golf every day. He works out, eats well, just has a real passion for life. So he talks about pursuing your passion no matter the age. Tom Watson, he shares the fact that picking mentors, really good mentors, are key to one's success. His mentors, when he was growing up, were Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, who he later played against and was rivals against, even though they remained very good friends, and Byron Nelson. Ben Crenshaw talks about destiny and having faith and belief. Renee Powell, as I mentioned, she's in the show. She talks about really overcoming all the odds and never let anybody else define you, which I think is a great message. Annika Sörenstam talks about the fact that there are no shortcuts to success. Work ethic is key. She also talks about the importance of having patience. Nancy Lopez talks about positivity. There are so many great messages in this book. I'm just so excited to share it with you. Life on the Green: Lessons and Wisdom from Legends of Golf. My thanks to Hank Gola, to Bill Byrne, and to Mike Goodsell in production. May you have the courage, and it takes courage to choose love over hate. Have a great weekend. Be kind. Love one another. And I look forward to talking with you next time, right here on Sports Interview with Anne LaCorne.